Good afternoon. It's 4:30 and you're listening to KDNK. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh and this is Valley Voices. My guest today is Captain Paul Watson, founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. He started the organization in 1977. The group is infamous for ramming or sinking whaling ships, Taiwanese drift netters, and other illegal fishing boats. But in 2000, Watson changed his tack, so to speak, and is working in partnership with governments around the world to stop poaching and illegal fishing. Watson's also been called a pirate, a moniker that he has embraced. A little self-disclosure, I went on a mission with the Sea Shepherds in 1991 out of Key West, chasing the Taiwanese drift net fleet in the Caribbean. I caught up with Captain Watson at our day. Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you.
I saw recently where the Costa Rican Environment Minister, Carlos Manuel Rodriguez, called you a conservation hero and mentioned that a long-standing criminal case against you could be dropped. Can you talk about that case and what his words mean for you?
It's a very bizarre case because it goes way back to 2002. And on my way to Costa Rica that year, we encountered a shark finning operation in the waters of Guatemala. So I contacted the Guatemalan government. They asked me if I could stop them, which we did. We didn't hurt anybody. We didn't damage anything, but we did stop them. That boat proceeded to Costa Rica ahead of us. And when we arrived in Costa Rica, I found myself charged with 8 counts of attempted homicide because the fishermen said I tried to kill them. Well, we weren't too concerned about it because we were making the film Sharkwater, so we had a film crew on board. So we went into the courts and we showed them the footage, and they dismissed the charges. And then a week later, I'm on the boat, and they come and arrest me again, this time for 8 counts of attempted assault. So again, we go into the courts, and we show the film, and again, they dismiss the charges. And this time, they gave me a clearance to leave, so I left. Never thought another thing about it for 10 years until I landed in Frankfurt, Germany, and was arrested on an extradition warrant from Costa Rica for a crime called shipwreck endangerment, which nobody even seemed to know what it was.
Shipwreck endangerment.
It's a kind of a terrorist charge.
Okay.
And that charge actually resulted after a meeting between the then president of Costa Rica, Laura Chinchilla, and the prime minister of Japan. So we felt that the Japanese put them up to this. So the charge in itself contradicts itself because it says that I interfered with this operation, this illegal operation in international waters, but it gives a position well within Guatemalan waters.
Oh.
I didn't go to Costa Rica to face the charges for a very good reason, because I knew I would win the case, but then they would immediately put me on a plane and deport me to Japan. So that's the reason I didn't go to face it. So just this last month, within the last month, there's a new government in Costa Rica, and the new environment minister called me. And he said they're going to look into this whole thing. It's very political. At the same time, my lawyer in Costa Rica has laid criminal charges against 10 judges. Because these judges operated illegally, they ignored the statute of limitations, they ignored my rights, they did all sorts of things. And to give you an indication of how they ignored my rights, when I was arrested back in 2002, they didn't allow me contact with my embassy or the consulate. They said they did, and to prove it, they said, we told him he could contact the United States embassy, and he refused.
Whoops.
And my lawyer said, well, that was pretty strange since he was a Canadian citizen. So they actually ended up having to pay $50,000 in fines for that. But it looks like it's going to be turned around now. It's the case has been under investigation by a European Parliamentary Committee looking into abuses with Interpol and by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights.
Okay.
And in the meantime, what happened when I was arrested in Germany, there wasn't a red list for me. But I was under house arrest in Germany, in Frankfurt, when I got a call from a supporter in the Ministry of Justice. And he said, on Monday, when you go in to report to the police, they're going to extradite you to Japan. That's when I decided to leave Germany. So I jumped bail in Germany, and it was a month later that I was put on the Interpol red list. I didn't have any papers at all. I have a Canadian and American passport, but they had taken them. So I had to leave, and I went halfway around the world to rejoin my ship off of American Samoa, and I did that without any papers. And then I spent the next 15 months in exile in the South Pacific. Until what happened was that the Japanese charged me for conspiracy to board a whaling ship. And that was based on the arrest of one person, Captain Pete Bethune, of the boat called the Adi Gil, which wasn't our boat. He was working with us. But he was charged with trespassing. Now, I'm on camera on Whale Wars advising him not to board that vessel.
Mm-hmm.
but he did it anyway. So when he got to Japan, they made a deal with him. Suspend his sentence in exchange for saying that I ordered him to board that boat. So that's what they did, and I was charged with conspiracy to trespass on a whaling ship.
He
did that, but also a year and a half later, he signed an affidavit saying he lied to the Japanese. And John Kerry is Secretary of State, and he accepted. He said, well, this is bullshit. You can come back in. But Japan refuses to accept that affidavit, and they're sticking to that charge. You know, Interpol is under investigation for political bias on that because they were pressured into doing it. Nobody gets on the red list for that kind of a charge. This is serial killers and war criminals and everything like this.
So you're still on the red list, the Interpol red list. Now, if all of this stuff is cleared up in Costa Rica, how will that impact the red list?
Because nobody takes the Japanese one seriously. The Costa Rican one was being taken more seriously than the Japanese. Everybody knows that the Japanese one is politically motivated. And that's what my lawyers have been telling me anyway. So, but I can't leave the country. I can go to France. France is the only country I can actually go into legally. But I can't then come back. I could come back when John Kerry was Secretary of State, but God knows what would happen now. Because when you come into the country, it triggers the red list. And they don't even ask questions. They just arrest you.
So you're living in the United States now.
Yeah, I am a U.S. citizen, and I live in Vermont, although for the last few months I've been taking care of a vessel in San Diego.
You know, you mentioned earlier today during your talk that the Sea Shepherds changed tack, so to speak, in 2000. What made you decide to do that?
Opportunity, really, is that that was when we got into a partnership with Ecuador over the protection of the Galapagos and the Galapagos Marine Reserve. And we realized what we could accomplish through that kind of partnership. So since 2000, we've provided a patrol boat. We set up an AIS system in the Galapagos. We've provided a canine unit to sniff out smuggling wildlife parts and everything. We've provided legal advice and all this. So it's been a 18-year partnership with Ecuador over there, and it's worked out very well. Since then, we've now partnered with numerous countries, Mexico, Gabon, Liberia, Tanzania, Italy, and that's working out extremely well. Because, see, the problem that we've had over the years is we can operate in international waters, and we use the United Nations World Charter for Nature as our mandate to do it. That allows for non-government organizations to intervene, although the law is still pretty, on the fence. But this way, we have absolute authority when we intervene. For instance, in Mexico, we've been there for 4 years. Now, the first 3 years were really frustrating because we had permission to go out and confiscate nets. We had permission to find poachers, and we were finding poachers, but every time we found them, we called the Navy. It'd take them hours to come, and then there was nobody to arrest. So this year was a change that the Mexican government put six sailors on board, armed sailors on board. So now when we find poachers, they have no choice. They have to intervene.
So do you consider yourself working for these governments?
Working in partnership with them. So this last week, or just actually this week, we're signing, in fact I have to sign it today really, we're signing two more convenios with the Mexican government, one to extend for Milagro 5 to return in November to protect the Paquita Refuge, and one to protect the new marine sanctuary. So we'll be having a full-time patrol boat in the marine sanctuary. I have four United States Coast Guard island class of patrol vessels. Mm-hmm. And so two of them are working with Mexico, one of them is in the Caribbean, and one of them is in Australia.
Talk about Operation Milagro.
Well, Operation Milagro, which means miracle, is to prevent the extinction of the endangered vaquita and also to protect the endangered totoaba fish. Vaquita is the smallest and most endangered marine mammal or porpoise on the planet. Totoaba is a fish. It's about the same size as the vaquita, and that's why the vaquita gets caught in these nets. Now, the totoaba is fished for only one thing, its swim bladder, which is sold in China for $20,000 a kilo. So that's why there's incredible motivation to go get this fish. We actually find so many of these fishes with just their insides torn out and the carcasses are there. They set the nets in the Paquita Refuge when the totoaba are up there between November and June. And so we're just leaving now. So when they set the nets, we fly drones at night to catch them in the act, and then we go there and confiscate those nets and get in the Navy to go after them. It's a little dangerous. They've shot at us. They shot three of our drones down, and last month they actually fired on our ship, but the Navy returned fire. Nobody was hit, fortunately. The cartels are behind this because there's so much money involved in it. $20,000 a kilo, that's a lot of money. And, I mean, we have pulled so many vaquita out of those nets, probably quite a few million dollars worth of vaquita, some alive, some dead. Okay. The ones that are dead are disposed of by the Mexican government. The ones that are alive, we put back.
Would you say that this is maybe the most dangerous mission Sea Shepherd has undertaken?
No, I wouldn't. It's hard to really say what's dangerous and what isn't. I mean, we've been fired up. We've been shot at by poachers. Going after any poacher is dangerous. You never really know. I mean, the ice fish thing, we chased that vessel for 110 days. They threw bolts and chains at us. We didn't know if they had guns. They didn't do that. But you don't really know what to suspect of them. In my lifetime, I've been fired at by whalers and threatened, of course, and I've been shot once. And before,
shot?
Yeah, I was down the Southern Ocean, but I had a bulletproof vest on, so bang, right here.
Who shot you?
Somebody on the Japanese boat. It's interesting because they denied it, but it's on camera. It's caught on camera. Their first statement out to the Australian government is they fired warning shots, and then when they found out I had been hit, they came out with, we fired warning balls, whatever that is. They were throwing concussion grenades at us.
I remember on the mission that I went on in 1991, you had a cannon on your ship.
We had a cannon, but we never fired anything other than just a lot of black smoke. It was one, we dispersed a bunch of poachers off of Cocos Island one time with that because, we told them to leave and they didn't, so we fired the cannon straight at them. And, of course, nothing came out, but they didn't know that, so they left.
I want to talk a little bit about another couple of campaigns. One that you didn't really mention in your talk, and then one that you did. Talk about shark finning. I mean, why should people in the U.S. care? And then talk about the connection between finning and Starbucks.
I can start with the finning and Starbucks thing that just recently happened, is that in Hong Kong, Starbucks has partnered with a restaurant chain, which is notorious for marketing shark fin soup. And I think it violates Starbucks' own code of environmental ethics. So I don't think Starbucks is really aware of it. Hopefully they'll take some action on it now that we've exposed it. I know it must be difficult for these big companies sometimes because you never know what you're stepping in, when you do these alliances and things. About 75 to 80 million sharks are killed every year. Mm-hmm. And one of the main products out of that is shark fins, which has no nutritional value at all. It's a texturing for soup, which is either pork or chicken or beef, really.
And this is used in the United States?
Well, it is in very exclusive restaurants, but it's mainly in China. China has taken measures to ban it at state dinners, but it's a status symbol. It's $100 a plate, on average, $100 a bowl. So when people have weddings, they can boast of their status by serving shark fin soup. Mm-hmm. But we're working on getting that word out in China that, we've got actually celebrities who said they wouldn't have it at their wedding and such like this. Mm-hmm. So it's really an educational program. The other way is tackling at the source, which is the poachers, and confiscating the long lines and the nets that take them. We arrested one vessel in the Galapagos last year that had 6,000 sharks. We stopped a Chinese fleet in East Timor last year and had it under arrest for 17 months, and we estimated that saved 600,000 sharks because that's what it would have killed during that time.
When you talk about how it's a status symbol, it's a cultural thing, and how do you convince an entire culture that this needs to stop because it's endangering fish?
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, we have our own cultural problems, too. For instance, I don't see any difference between, Africans eating chimpanzees and elephants and giraffe. They call it bushmeat. Well, bluefin tuna is bushmeat, so it's really the same thing. So our cultural thing in this day is eating animals which really, if we looked at it from another point of view, is really abhorrent, like bluefin tuna, for example. We don't treat marine wildlife or marine animals the way we treat land animals. We just take everything out of the ocean without regardless of that. We disregard the fact that they're a viable part of our ecological system. So I'd say that a fish in the water is serving us better in the water than it is on anybody's plate by maintaining the ecological integrity of the ocean.
Are you vegan?
Yes, all our ships are vegan.
You're listening to Valley Voices. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh. My guest today is Captain Paul Watson, who founded the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society in 1977. Last August, something really weird happened off the coast of Washington. A farm-raised Atlantic salmon. Mm-hmm. The pen collapsed, and they got out into the Pacific Ocean. What are your thoughts about salmon farming?
Well, we're totally opposed to salmon farming. It's one of the most destructive fisheries out there for a number of reasons. One, to raise one salmon on a farm takes an average of 70 fish caught from the ocean to provide the food to raise it. You know, so wherefore we're decimating anchovy, mackerel, and sardine populations off of Chile and Argentina and different places like this just to provide the fish meal to feed these wild salmon on the farms. We suspect that in the Faroe Islands and Norway, they're actually using whale meat on that. We haven't been able to prove it yet.
Fish are eating whale meat?
Yeah, in the Faroe Islands, I haven't been able to prove it, but I'm just looking at the amount of whale meat they get, the amount of whale meat they actually consume themselves, mm-hmm. and there's not accounting for like hundreds of tons of whale meat, so we don't know where it's gone to. So I haven't been able to get any direct proof on that, just okay. that circumstantial evidence. But the other thing is that it's chemically intensive, a lot of growth hormones, a lot of antibiotics. Even they have to dye the fish while it's still alive, put an artificial coloring in it to duplicate the coloring in the wild salmon, because they get that coloring from eating krill. It's incredible pollution from these salmon farms. They're like dead zones around these farms. The other thing that we caught them last year with is an illegal fishery. The feed actually attracts herring. The herring come into the nets, and that provides food for the salmon, but it actually is a fishery because they're taking hundreds of tons of herring out of the ocean. They shoot bears and eagles and seals and anything that they think is a threat to their salmon farms.
So they think that the carnivores are coming after the salmon farms.
Here's the worst thing about them. There's seven native species of salmon on the Pacific coast. Okay. And they have no antibiotics. They don't have any. They're not immune from those retroviruses that are being spread by the salmon farms. And this Norwegian disease, which actually weakens the heart muscles and everything. So that's getting into the wild salmon populations. Sea lice or salmon lice, this louse, which is rampant in the salmon farms, it gets out and attaches itself to young salmon coming down the streams and it kills them. So the transmission of parasites and viruses is, I think, the major problem that we have there. And also, you know, if you or I were to take a piranha and put it into, say, a lake in Colorado, that would be a crime. So how can they put this huge carnivore, a bigger species, in an ecosystem it doesn't belong? It's in Chile, it's in Tasmania, it's in British Columbia. All these places is the introduction of an exotic carnivore into a system it doesn't belong. And they get away with it because the Canadian Department of Fisheries Oceans just doesn't deal with it. They just turn a blind eye to it. They're pro the salmon farms, they're against wild salmon. I mean, they've overseen the destruction of the cod fishery. They've overseen the destruction of pretty much every fishery that they're supposed to be responsible for. So they've been proven to be very, very incompetent. It's all about serving their corporate masters and not the people who pay the taxes.
Right. So how do we stop salmon farming? I mean, you mentioned earlier that there are some places that have actually outlawed it.
Well, Washington State has outlawed it because after that disaster where they actually tried to blame that collapse of that salmon farm on the eclipse of the sun.
I remember that.
That led a lot of impetus to what we're trying to do in British Columbia. So in 4 days, the premier of British Columbia has to either decide whether to renew their licenses. Now, the salmon farms did something untoward. They simply restocked like 3 months ago. So, mm-hmm. you know, to try and get around this. But I don't know what the premier would do. It was an election campaign promise. But the other day he was sort of indicating he was going to pass the buck to the federal government, which we know where they're going to go. It's a $1 billion industry, and he's already reneged on the Site C Dam. All these guys, they promised the world, and they delivered nothing.
Well, Paul Watson, you've been doing this work for over 40 years. You've been out on the oceans of the world for four decades.
It's actually longer than that because I was the youngest co-founder of Greenpeace, and that was in 69. So it's almost 5 decades.
Decades. Talk about the changes you've seen due to global warming and when you first started noticing significant changes.
Well, I think, the fact that I was raised in an Eastern Canadian fishing village, and just comparing the winters that we experienced as children to the winters now is certainly the first indication. As a sailor, you can notice the changes in the trade winds and that in the Pacific. I thought it was quite amusing when they had these large ice cover around Antarctica, mm-hmm. and all the deniers said, look at this. There's never been so much ice around Antarctica. This is evidence that there's no global warming. I said, no, it's evidence that there is global warming because all that ice is from fresh water melt, which is coming down off the glaciers. So there's more fresh water going into the sea, But so you see all of these measures. Of course, there's the migration of species. Just in Great Britain alone, every year the species are being found further north every year. the key to climate change is very simple, and it's one that they didn't even want to hear at the climate change conference in Paris, is that leave the ocean alone. The ocean will take care of the whole problem. It'll repair itself. The ocean regulates climate and temperature. Give the ocean time to repair itself, and it'll heal.
Well, like what kind of time?
Well, I would say we need a moratorium between 50 and 100 years on all commercial fishing.
Okay.
Will that happen? Probably not. But it's going to happen one way or the other, because if it collapses, it's going to happen.
Right.
You just can't continue to assault the marine ecosystems this way and expect it to survive. Mm-hmm. But greed drives all these forces, you know. You know, and also they don't care if it goes. Like Mitsubishi, they got bluefin tuna in their warehouse. They got 10, 15 years supply. They could stop fishing today and allow the species to recover, but they won't do it. Because if that happens and the bluefin start to rise in the ocean, the price of the commodity goes down in the warehouses. If it goes extinct, they've got a priceless commodity that they can set the price on. Already, an average price for a bluefin tuna in Japan is $75,000 for one fish.
For one fish. Now, they're big fish, but still, one fish.
The first one every year goes for about $1 million, you know.
You still claim that no one has been injured or killed on your missions. To what do you attribute that?
I think we're very cautious on that, but I don't. Other than that, I can't really say why. You know, like I was invited to give a talk to the FBI Academy in Quantico.
You're kidding.
And they paid me to come speak to them. And one of the agents, special agents there, he says, well, you know, Sea Shepherd walks a pretty fine line when it comes to the law. And I said, yeah, well, who cares how fine it is as long as you don't cross the line, eh? And he said, well, I can't disagree with that. But, you know, some of your people have gone on to become eco-terrorists. And I said, like who? He said, well, Rod Coronado. I said, hey, he liberated some mink from a mink farm, if you call that eco-terrorist. But I said, besides, he did that well after he left Sea Shepherd, so it's not my responsibility. And he said, you trained him, you're responsible. I said, well, I got some names for you, Lee Harvey Oswald, Timothy McVeigh, and Osama bin Laden. You trained him.
Do you still fly the Hayagriva Griva flag?
Oh, the Tibetan flag? No, I don't know why we don't, but we do fly the flag of the Five Nations.
Okay.
So the Mohawks invited me there in 2008 and presented us with a flag, so we're the only ships that fly that, and so all our ships are flying the flag of the Five Nations. And that's based on the Iroquois understanding that we don't make any decision unless we take into account the impact on all future generations. And we still have the support of the Dalai Lama.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because I remember it was the first question I asked you when I interviewed you in 91 is about wrathful compassion.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's because this little statue that that was sent to me in 1985 by a Tibetan Buddhist monk, and didn't know why or where it came from, but I did ask the Dalai Lama in 1989. I showed him a picture of it, and he told me it was called Hayagriva. He sent it. And I said, what's that mean? He says, it's a symbol for the compassionate aspect of the wrath of the Buddha. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what's that mean? He says, well, you never want to hurt anybody, but sometimes when they cannot see enlightenment, you have to scare the hell out of them until they do.
So that's what you've been doing for 50 years.
Yeah, it's intimidation. That's, you know, the whole pirate logo and everything like that, you know, tends to be, you know, when we show up, these guys run like that toothfish basically. They drop their nets and ran. Mm-hmm. And our second boat picked up their nets. But it's a bit of an intimidation. The history of piracy is one that's been completely misunderstood. The pirates in the Caribbean, for example, which I always thought were good guys, you know. And the reason being is they were so far ahead of their time. They elected their captains. People of color, women, could rise to the highest level on their ranks in those ships. Blackbeard would attack slave ships, free the slaves, and give them a choice. Go ashore or else join my crew. And then they could, you know, rise to mates or whatever. Mm-hmm. But they were all thieves. Yeah, they stole from the Spanish. You stole it from the Aztecs, so how the hell is that a crime? And in a world where a boy of 10 could be hung in London for stealing a loaf of bread, that's why they took those risks. As Anne Bonny, a pirate, said, they said it's the death penalty for being a pirate. And she said, well, thank God for it, too. If it wasn't for that, every idiot would be out here doing this. But they also cut right through the bureaucracy. It was Henry Morgan who shut down the pirates off of Panama and everything like this. And so that's the thing I like about it, is they just cut through the red tape and just get things done. So look at all the great pirates in history. John Paul Jones, the founder of the United States Navy, who also was the founder of the Russian Navy. Not many people realize that. You know, Sir Francis Drake, Sir Walter Raleigh, in the Battle of New Orleans, Jean Lafitte, who was a hero there. They're all pirates, so they've got a bad rap. You know who the worst pirates were? The ones that didn't exist, like Long John Silver. They gave pirates a bad name.
So, you know, do you consider yourself a pirate?
I like it because kids like it.
Okay.
So, you know, the kids like the image, they like the flag. When people started calling us pirates in the 80s and there, 90s, okay, well, we'll be pirates. And we got our own Jolly Roger, because every pirate had their own Jolly Roger. And like I said, the kids really love it. And to give you an idea of how popular it is, we used to have our shirts with the whale logo on it. So today we sell 20 of the pirate logos for one of those. So it's, from a marketing point of view, it's pretty good.
Captain Paul Watson, after 50 years, golly, 50 years doing this work, have we made any progress?
Well, I think we made a lot of progress as far as awareness. You know, when I look at what the world was like in the 70s and 80s and everything, you know, people in 1972 didn't even know what ecology was, right. You know, and all Earth Day happened in 72 and things happened. And also a lot of things have gone backwards. Like in 72, at the United Nations Conference on the Environment in Stockholm, the number one thing on the agenda was human overpopulation. By 1992, at the conference in Rio de Janeiro, nobody wanted to talk about it, and they still don't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. So we tend to bury our heads in the sand on some things, and like climate change, we're also burying our heads in the sand on that. It's like we have this idea that this can go on and on and on. Actually, to me, there's one thing that's ties us all together. It's our philosophical point of view of what I call anthropocentrism versus biocentrism. Mm-hmm. All indigenous people were biocentric. All civilized, so-called civilized people are anthropocentric. So it's the dominance of anthropocentrism. Mm-hmm. Every single world religion holds human beings at the center. And because of that, those are all anthropocentric religions. I think we have to do away with anthropocentrism in order to live in harmony with the natural world.
Captain Paul Watson, thank you very much for your work and for taking the time to talk with me today.
Well, thank you.
You've been listening to Valley Voices and a conversation with Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society.